And our sermon text today is Song of Solomon 3, verses 6 to 11. What is that coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant? Behold, it is the litter of Solomon. Around it are 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords and expert in war, each with his sword at his thigh against terror by the night. King Solomon made himself a carriage from the wood of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, and its seat of purple. Its interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go out, O daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. This is just great poetry in Hebrew. It really is. I read this passage, and I thought about my high school friend, Danny. His dad had a bit of money, and they lived in one of the posh suburbs in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Now, my friend Danny was a bit insecure around girls, and he tried to compensate by impressing them with big things and big talk. He was the only one in school who owned a Corvette convertible. And of course, in the 60s, that was like the chariot of the gods. And he drove that car everywhere, to school, to football games, dances, and especially downtown around the circuit, where the whole purpose was to see and be seen in your car, right, in those days, by other kids from other high schools, too, around the city. And Danny was always a big hit. Well known for his car. And Danny persuaded many girls to ride with him for certain. Any girl who rode with him would automatically become high profile by riding in his high profile car. To top it all off, Danny's father also owned a great boat, which he docked in Grand Haven, which is a port city right on one of the most beautiful places along Lake Michigan. And in high school, I lived on the beaches of Lake Michigan in the summer. An invitation to one of Danny's summer parties on his boat was always a coveted thing. All the rest of us lonely Bronken bucks with a pink carnation and a pickup truck. You recognize that line, right, from The Day the Music Died? I was one of those guys, that lonely Bronken buck with a pink carnation and a pickup truck. We all tried to make sure we got one of those invitations because we knew that's where all the girls would be. Danny's reputation was enviable and legendary at our high school. He was always surrounded by girls, and he never lacked for a date for the prom or any other occasion. But he was never with any one girl for very long, and behind all of the bravado, he seemed sad and alone. In fact, once at a party when he was drunk, he slobbered out a kind of self-pitying confession to a couple of us, where he expressed his doubts about whether the girls he was with really liked him for his car or for who he was. It was a rare moment of self-reflection. It is our assertion that the Song of Solomon, and to some extent Ecclesiastes, is a kind of biblical expression of some of the same things when it comes to Solomon. No one of his generation had access to more resources to impress than Solomon. He was the richest, wisest, most famous king of his day. And yet something rings hollow about it all, doesn't it? We saw this, it was a major theme of Ecclesiastes, and it's becoming a major theme of the Song of Solomon, too. My wife, Debbie, finished listening to Song of Solomon for the umpteenth time the other week. She listens to the Bible on MP3 four times, gets through the Bible four times a year. But she now hears it with a new perspective that we've been unfolding for you. She came in from chores one day and concluded after listening to the Song of Solomon that it was Solomon's dedication to the one that got away, the Shulamite woman. I like that. You're going to hear that quite often in the series, the remainder of the series. The Shulamite is the one who refused to be overwhelmed by Solomon's equivalence of his Corvette and boat and big home and airplane and money. His rock star reputation with the ladies could not, in the end, lure her from her commitment to the simple biblical covenant love with her shepherd boy. And we'll see this play out consistently as we make our way through the song. So let's continue then to make our way through the song. First of all, with verses 6 through 8, and access your outline there if you would. And you parents need to take this home with your kids. And don't pretend like you didn't hear anything here today. Take it home and sit down with your kids and talk through the issues. It's a perfect opportunity for you to do so. Don't waste it. First of all, verses 6 through 8. Pomp and circumstance. That's our title, Pomp and Circumstance. Solomon and his retinue is calculated to overwhelm any harem girl. Solomon and his retinue is calculated to overwhelm any harem girl. He's trying to persuade her. She's the one who gets away, right? But he's doing his best to overwhelm her. Now, we've taken a break with Pentecost and Trinity Sunday, but you may remember from several weeks ago the stark contrast with our text today. And you need to go back and reaccess that sermon. Perhaps you were gone and didn't hear it. You need to set up the contrast here by maybe reviewing the text or going back and hearing that message too, because there's a deliberate stark contrast with our text today of Solomon and all of his whiz-bang pomp and circumstance to the simple, poignant dream of the Shulamite girl for her shepherd boy, which is in truth far more real. That was one of the ironies we saw in that text. Her dream was far more real in terms of biblical love than what Solomon is putting forth here. Far more real in its covenant love and commitment than what we'll see today from Solomon. She says, "On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not." And she goes on from there, right? Her dream is deliberately contrasted. It is far more real in its covenant love and commitment than the so-called reality we'll see unfold with Solomon as he arrives. She searches longingly throughout the city in several adventures until she finds him and brings him to the covenant shelter of her mother's house and chamber. That chamber being a double entendre there, the chamber of the womb, if you will, bearing the Shulamite girl. It's a place of safety and love and protection where she was conceived. And this prompts her second adjuration, as you remember. And we have seen that the adjurations, there are four of them in this book, the adjurations all serve the same purpose. They are a climactic high point. They are dividing lines as well. They determine our outline and reaccess our introduction where that outline is given you. And you'll see that the whole book is outlined by the four adjurations. And those adjurations in English, it's from Latin, ad jure, that is to law. These adjurations are the demand for a legal covenant oath laid upon the harem girls to swear not to incite all the fruits of covenant love, sex, intimacy, the pretense of love. That's the definition of harem love, or of harem life. The adjuration invokes the harem girls to swear not to incite all of these fruits of covenant love without the substance of it. That is a lifetime commitment of covenant love between one man and one woman that is rock solid and white hot, as Miles Van Pelt puts it so accurately. That lifetime commitment of covenant love between one man and one woman, sworn publicly then with signs and seals of that covenant too. None of that happens in harem life. Nothing could be starker than what transpires next in our text today. And the Hebrew text is brilliant in bringing this to us. Just exquisite poetry. Poetry is always the last thing comprehended by the newbie in studying a language. But it's often the most eloquent and elegant and beautiful of what a language has to offer, too, the poetry. I remember taking my kids through Latin poetry when we were doing Latin. That was the last thing we did, and it was still incomprehensible to our kids by the time we got. I just got so frustrated. Not only trying to teach it to my kids, but learn it myself. All the nuances and all the freight a language can bear is caught up in its poetry. And it's true here. And so we see the Hebrew text is brilliant in bringing this contrast to us. First of all, in contrast to the shelter and intimacy of her mother's house, that inner chamber, in contrast to this, we see the awestruck exclamation, "What is that coming up from the wilderness?" Some translations have desert for wilderness. And it's the barrenness of the desert and the wilderness. The barrenness of the wilderness is deliberately drawn starkly with the fecundity of the mother's house, that inner chamber of conception. A double entendre there, an allusion to the womb. Who conceived me, right? In one model, you have biblical covenant love. Children are conceived and born and nurtured. In the other, that is, in harem life, you have the pleasure-seeking king. And you have barrenness and childlessness that is characteristic of it, too. Covenant love is as fruitful as a mother's womb. Harem life is as barren as the wilderness. And a kind of crass commercialism and emptiness is painted in the remainder of verse 6, too. Once again, it as well, full of irony and double entendre. The columns of smoke stirred up by Solomon's entourage as it approaches from a distance are the same columns of smoke used to describe a fire that wastes and destroys. But this is a fire, of course, of myrrh and frankincense, right? The fires of love, supposedly. But ironically, myrrh and frankincense are used in burial ceremonies too, not just the bedroom, evoking for us a death-like pall. And the fragrant powders of a merchant evoke the noisy, bustling setting of a street market, too, not the quiet intimacy of the bedroom. These metaphors were carefully, deliberately constructed to make us chuckle or maybe wince at the double meaning in which they could be taken. And it's not any one metaphor or allusion that seals it for us, but the consistent accumulation of them that persuades us that Solomon is sadly drawing the contrast as he composes this. After being humbled by years of the vanity of it all, sadly drawing the contrast between his pursuit of pleasure and the Shulamite's faithfulness to biblical covenant love, the one that got away. Well, then, what is it that's making such an ironic stir? Whoa, wow, behold, it's the Corvette of Solomon. Or maybe the presidential limousine. The entourage of Solomon. The Hebrew word there is used to describe a litter, as it is in our translation. Or, more accurately, a bedchamber or a carriage. Any one of these translations, depending on the context, though, what do you think it might be alluding to, right? It's a mobile love nest, if you will. A bedchamber. The exclamation point in the ESV is there because the Hebrew emphasizes it too. Behold! One is supposed to be impressed, overwhelmed by Solomon's arrival upon the scene in his stretch limo. Or maybe since he's king, maybe it's Air Force One, right? The Air Force One portable bedroom. It's a scene of ancient pomp and circumstance. Grand entrances and exits today are done on airport tarmacs, right? Where red carpets are rolled out, heads of state ascend or descend aircraft stairs, or they stumble like old fools who should be on handicap seats going up and down like Joe Frauden. In contrast, Solomon is in the full flower of his powers, unlike our present occupant of the Oval Office. Solomon, rather, is in full flower of his powers, and he makes a rock star JFK entrance on Air Force One to the oohs and ahs of the harem girls, and more pertinently, in contrast to the shepherd boy, too. We are meant to keep in mind the shepherd boy sought by the Shulamite woman, and he is in utter contrast to that shepherd boy, attempting indeed to impress our Shulamite girl. We'll get a more detailed description of Air Force One here momentarily. But additionally, we are meant to be impressed by the elite corps of Secret Service or Praetorian Guard troops which surround Solomon. These are the 60 mighty men wearing swords, expert in war, ready to fight at any moment, right? Against terror by night. But remember, this is Hebrew poetry, okay? The emphasis on mighty men is immediately evocative of David's 30 mighty men, which were men of renown like Abishai or Azahel or Elhanan, whose military exploits are detailed for us in 2 Samuel 23. That's a rollicking good tale, too, the description of those mighty men, whether they were killing hundreds of Philistines with a spear or winning great battles single-handedly. These were all in the early days of the kingdom period of Israel, when David was becoming established, those exciting days of yesteryear, if you will. And their stories were told and retold around the campfires and dinner tables of Israel. And little boys grew up wanting to enlist and become the next Audie Murphy or George Patton or Chris Kyle, of American Sniper, right? But as time and decadence began to set in, it does that with every empire, doesn't it? Decadence and time. Things get inflated and exaggerated in order to impress and seem even greater than the past. And so instead of 30 mighty men, you have 60. They're all experts in war, each with a sword. That was kind of like the Barrett 50 cal of the day. And our translation says, against terror. Against terror. And I have Ian Provan to thank. His commentary on Song of Solomon sometimes gets into the grammar, descends into the weeds of the grammar sometimes. But you have to do that with Hebrew poetry, especially. And this is how the ESV translates what is a more ambiguous preposition in the Hebrew, and it's inflected in the grammar. Against could also be translated on behalf of. Instead of against terror, they are there for terror. That is, to instill terror. Both nuances are there and meant to be there, I would submit to you. That's what poetry does. Sometimes has several different nuances, several different ways you can take it. The sense would then be that the 60 were the aggressors, perpetrators of terror in the night. That's the sense of double entendre throughout this section, throughout the book, for that matter. Just as the bureaus and agency and departments of corrupt, tyrannical states become aggressors and perpetrators of terror and tyranny on their own people, so the 60 could be seen as there to intimidate and provoke fear and terror as well. Just as Esther, and we need to refer for context oftentimes to the book of Esther on what harems were like, just as Esther was taken from Mordecai and put into the harem rotation of King Ahasuerus, so any fine young prospect could be encouraged to join the harem. Come and join us, as they're trying to do here with the Shulamite girl. It was an honor, and it was a tremendous opportunity, too, for any peasant girl, so very few objected. But if she or her older brothers or her father objected, there were always those buff, mighty men with their swords standing in the background, smiling and ready to jump into action if anyone objected too strenuously. And perhaps a 10th century BC version of a SWAT team might drop in on you at 4 in the morning, smashing down your door, ordering everyone up and out of bed, bringing in the young lady for questioning and inspection, instilling terror in the night throughout the neighborhood. That is also the sense of terror in the night. Bringers of terror in the night as well. Intimidating. Ivan the Terrible of Russia. This has happened throughout history, right? It's not distinct to the period of Solomon. It's not distinct to the period of the Soviet Union or Hitler and the Third Reich. Ivan the Terrible of Russia, when he was ready to marry, commanded all of his nobles to present their daughters to him for inspection, on pain of death if they refused. He had his own mighty men. He had his own terror squad. And over 1,500 girls went through his inspection mill until he found the one to his liking. And later, Ivan the Terrible, you can see why he was called terrible. Just one reason he was called terrible. But later, Ivan took a second and then a third wife in the same fashion. And his third selection, a peasant girl from the steppes, took sick and died when she was informed of her fate. Ivan, by this time, being a creepy, shriveled old Joe Frauden, the stories of his abuse and twisted ways were legend, as they are with both Joe and Hunter Frauden in our own day. Solomon, in a very effective literary style, communicates the perks and privileges of power when wielded to overwhelm. In this case, a poor peasant girl he wants for his harem. Next week, we'll see him use flattery. Today, he uses pomp and circumstance and implicit force. And we see it further employed in the description of Air Force One, too. That brings us to point two, verses 9 through 10a. Pomp and circumstance. Solomon and his accoutrements are calculated to overwhelm any harem girl. Solomon and his accoutrements are calculated to overwhelm any harem girl. The details of his portable bedchamber, his stretch limo, his Air Force One, are given in order to contrast, again, with the simple, humble, maternal home and chamber of conception. Deliberately drawn in contrast. His portable bedchamber is made of the finest materials of the day, cedar from Lebanon, gold and silver and purple. Want a ride in my Rolls-Royce stretch limo, Shulamith? I got some candy here for you, too. Creepy Joe. Creepy Solomon. And, of course, the love with which the interior was inlaid is that with which we have seen characterized as harem life, too. All of the trappings and the fruits of covenant love. All of the trappings and fruits of covenant love, sex and intimacy and pleasure. But it's illicit sex. It's cheap intimacy. It's stolen pleasures. All the trappings and fruits of covenant love without the covenant commitments. The one man, one woman bond that we see between Shulamite and the shepherd boy. A love that is rock solid and white hot, as Miles Van Pelt characterizes it. And we see in chapter 8 those things given us. And signed and sealed in covenant ceremony. All those things are lacking. But Elvis is in the house. Elvis is in the house. The king is on a leather couch, and the door to his Rolls-Royce stretch limo is open. He and a gaggle of harem girls beckon you. They're on their way to beautiful, magical Graceland in Memphis. Old baby boomer women still make pilgrimage there, don't they? Old harem girls still made their way to Jerusalem. A life of love, quote unquote, a life of love and ease with a legendary rock star is available to you. That has always been the siren song of rock and roll, hasn't it? We've been going back and forth. The veil between past and present is pretty thin, isn't it? Some common themes in every generation. It's always been the siren song of rock and roll. Songs of love, the pursuit of love. But what is achieved, huh? Elvis died of a drug overdose, still surrounded by women. But he was fat, alone, and loveless. Despite building a singing life and career and empire around the idea of love, becoming a demigod in the process. And many of us followed him into that emptiness. Rock and roll sells its soul for love, like Faustus, but ends up empty and dead. Solomon will die of an overdose of idolatry. Solomon dies of an overdose of idolatry. Probably fat, alone, and loveless. We see that in the historical books, right? Despite building a kingdom based on love, right? Built his kingdom based on love. And in the end, if you hear the despair in Ecclesiastes, this too is vanity, he says. He will lament this throughout Ecclesiastes. And Solomon has his own adjuration of sorts. Many take the last part of verse 10 with 11, as I do, by the daughters of Jerusalem, right? That should go with verse 11, really. And so we include it in the outline in the next point. That brings us to the next point, 10b through verse 11. Pomp and circumstance. Solomon is out to overwhelm. He's going to get this girl one way or another, right? Pomp and circumstance. Solomon and his regal status is calculated to overwhelm any harem girl. The harem is commanded to stand and gaze in wonder at the king and his regalia, namely his crown. Implicit in all this is all the surrounding regalia that goes with it. And that crown, of course, was bestowed at the intervention of his mother, Bathsheba, on Solomon's behalf, even after King Adonijah had already been crowned king. David was still living. All of that story is recounted for us in 1 Kings chapter 1. Once again, a rollicking good tale. It's a classic story of court intrigue that no Victorian author could match in his or her wildest imagination. No. But as you read 1 Kings chapter 1, you see at the heart of that story is a plotting, conniving mother, Bathsheba. It was a day and time of a marriage of convenience, too, of utility to a daughter of Pharaoh. There indeed was gladness of heart. But of what sort? Once again, we're dealing with Hebrew poetry, with irony, with double entendre, with nuance. What kind of gladness of heart are we confronting here? Once again, keep in mind the first six verses of this chapter, first five verses, excuse me. You have the gladness of covenant love with Shulamith versus the gladness over acquisition of power. You have gladness over finding her shepherd boy, right, in her dream, versus the gladness of finding a queen to cement international relations. You have the gladness of a one-man, one-woman covenant love with Shulamite and the shepherd boy. And then on the other hand, in contrast, you have the gladness of making a playground of pleasure, a harem. And these are contrasts, nuances we are intended to draw. If you know how to read poetry. And once more, there is a deep irony and contrast as well with the mother of Shulamith and the mother of Solomon. Do you see that? These are parts of the nuance we're supposed to pick up on. A contrast between the mothers. You have the mother of Shulamith, who offers shelter and protection for both Shulamith and the shepherd boy. In contrast, you have with Bathsheba, a mother who facilitates exposing vulnerable young women to the predatory machinations of her son in the harem. You have, on the one hand, a mother who offers fecundity in conceiving children. That's the allusion once again to the chamber of her who conceived me in verse 4. That is the womb, a double entendre there. Chamber not only in terms of a physical room, but also the chamber of the womb, the mother who conceived. In contrast to a woman who offers the barrenness of the desert, the barrenness of the wilderness. Babies were born to concubines. Solomon got many concubines pregnant. But if indeed he practiced, as other idolatrous nations practiced, that is Egypt and Phoenicia, we know from the records, from the documents, if he practiced what they practiced, babies born to concubines were offered to Molech, sacrificed in the fires of Molech. Babies born to concubines. The barrenness of the desert and the wilderness. The barren womb. Deliberately meant to contrast. This deliberate, stark contrast between covenant love, which, as chapter 8 says, is as strong as death. And Van Pelt says, this means it's rock solid, right? And a covenant love that is the very fire of God, right? As chapter 8 puts it, Shulamite confesses this, that covenant love is as strong as death. It's rock solid. It's the very fire of God. That is, it's white hot. This covenant love is contrasted with this base, idolatrous harem love with a rock star. But it also has strong application to Christ and his church, too. Since the one man, one woman, faithful covenant love. And I hope you get a sense for this all through the book of the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon treats this one man, one woman, faithful covenant love, rock solid, white hot. Pictures the mutual fidelity of Christ to his bride, the church, and the church's fidelity to her groom, Christ Jesus. It is the mystery of Christ and the church, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, the very mystery of Christ and his church. And we see it pictured for us here in the covenant love and marriage between the shepherd boy and the Shulamite woman. And we have to ask ourselves, too, is it any wonder that Solomon lapsed into idolatry later in his life, practicing harem life, the pleasures of harem life, which he confesses, right, is vanity. Being faithless to the covenant model of marriage, the metaphor, it's no surprise that he would also despise the reality, that is, faithfulness to the covenant God who commanded, "You shall have no other gods before me." And every generation faces the same issues we find here in this book. Ladies, will you be indeed a Shulamith woman, a virtuous woman? One who bears the female version of the name Solomon. Will you be her? Or just another harem girl? There's a lot of just other harem girls out there sleeping around, pursuing their own secure goals, but they are in the end just another harem girl. Will you be that? Parents, take your kids home and talk to them about this. Don't just pretend you heard nothing here today. And men, are you Solomon wannabes? Right? You see what my friend Danny had. You see what Solomon had. You say, man, that's for me. I'm going to go out and see if I can get a recording contract and become a rock star myself, right? And get all this stuff, all the girls, right? Solomon wannabes. Or will you be that simple shepherd boy who finds joy in covenant love in that one man, one woman relationship outlined for us here in our text? And for all, is there that simple trust in Christ, which our model of marriage leads us to? That simple trust in Christ, our bridegroom. Or will we descend into idolatry as well, as so much of our nation has, and is condemned to judgment for it? Two bridegrooms beckon. They beckoned in Shulamith's day, and they beckon in our day too. To whom will you be wed? Young man, young woman, to whom will you be wed? It's much clearer for you now. Parents, the choice is much clearer for you to present to them now, and will be as we unfold the rest of this book. But until then, let us now come to that place where we do see the wedding of the Lamb to his church. We see it reprised in the body and blood of the Savior, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.